Blog Talk Radio.
Archangels, ghosts, and Bigfoot. Oh my! It's just another night for Supernatural Girls. Real stories, real answers to life's biggest supernatural mysteries. And now for another exciting interview with paranormal experts from this world and others. Psychic medium Helene Olson and paranormal researcher Patricia Baker. Here are Supernatural Girls.
Everyone, to another episode of Supernatural Girls. I am your host, Patricia Baker, and I am here with my very talented co-host, psychic medium Helene Olson. Hi, Helene.
Well, hello, Patricia. Hello, everyone.
So the atmosphere is charged tonight. We've got lots of stuff going on at the Supernatural Castle. You and
really?
I have... Yes, well,
different
you know
than
what?
Last night or a Monday night.
Monday night, every Monday night when we do our Skoll, Beyond Skoll experiment, we have new things happen. And this time we sent it out, I think you sent it out a picture in your newsletter last time, and this time I sent one out. We have become very acquainted with something called the vortex, and it's showing up in our photographs. It's so cool.
Well, I think there are lots of vortexes, but the one that's coming around us is amazing, as they
it
all are.
It is amazing. It is amazing. So
it's letting us take its picture.
It's so cool. Is that cool? That's cool.
It is.
And
it's
I think
amazing.
we're going to be able, at the end of the day here, we will have really great information to share with other people. So I'm hoping what's going to happen is we're going to learn all about this. We're going to unlock the code here, be able to share it with people, maybe do a workshop on it or whatever, and actually help people in their lives with what we're doing with the vortex energy. So if you haven't seen these pictures, guys, you've got to sign up on supernaturalgirls.com for the newsletters and also at angelslighthouse.com so you're on Helene's very special list for newsletters and also other events. But keep up with all of what we're doing here. We have a blog on Supernatural Castle, and there's more and more things that will be coming out. So make sure you're on the list so you can get the latest and greatest from us on what is happening. And there is a lot, wouldn't you say, Helene?
I would. They should sign up on my list because I have some new stuff coming on very shortly. So,
oh, right.
The sooner they get their name on it, the sooner they'll hear it next week.
Oh, yep. Right. Exciting, exciting. So here we are again, another crazy busy week for both of us, but I'm actually glad to be sitting down doing the show. It's kind of like a rest.
It's so much fun to do this show anyway. But the week has been crazy, and we finally got a little bit of heat here in New England.
Yes,
and
yes.
That's been a nice change, too, which I'm surprised I'm even saying that, because I really don't care for the humidity very much, but it was welcome. It's been a very cool summer, don't you think?
It has been, and I need to warm my bones before we move into this cold winter that's been predicted by the Farmer's Almanac. So, yeah, I'm happy with the heat. I can live with it. I really can.
Yeah. And I don't even listen to the news, and all they're screaming about is how cold and bitter the winter's going to be.
I can't stand it. I can't. Well, we got to talk to those vortex energies and see if we can make some changes here. So we got to keep warm. That's all there is to it. And, well, tonight we're going to be talking to William Hall, who is a really good researcher and author of The World's Most Haunted House. This was one heck of a story. Happened in the 70s. Actually, 1974, I believe, is when it was first reported.
Yeah.
This is an amazing story. I can't wait to get Bill on the line here, talking with all of us, telling us what happened.
Well, you know what I like about the book?
Tell me.
Is it really is an evidentiary document.
Yes, it is.
You know, it's not really hearsay at all. There are all kinds of reports and maps and, you know, if you like factual kinds of reports of the paranormal instead of this woo-woo spooky stuff that just you don't know whether it's right or wrong on television. This is backed up with all kinds of clear evidence. And
it really
even though,
is.
You know, you might not have the exact movie, you have very reputable people speaking to the exact events as they occurred, things that they cannot erase from their mind and still can't reconcile to this day. And so it's a very interesting read, even if you're kind of skeptical.
Exactly, exactly. And Bill's done a fantastic job with his book. Again, the title is The World's Most Haunted House, The True Story of the Bridgeport Poltergeist on Linley Street. And we're going to bring Bill on in just a few minutes. But first, we have our sister in numerology over here, who has joined us once again, Patricia Kirkman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm all excited about listening to Bill tonight. Woo!
Mm. Oh, gosh, yeah. This is going to be a wild ride. Yes.
Isn't it, though?
Yes. Yes, yes,
absolutely.
Yes. So
amazing.
You also have information for us on the Doctor Who companion. Now, her name is Clara in the show, and I watched the debut of the premiere last Saturday night of the new Doctor Who. I thought it was fabulous. She really held her own on the screen. So tell us about this very strong-minded lady.
Well, she's more than strong-minded. Her real name is Jenna Louise Coleman, and she's very concerned about what's just and fair, but she always multitasks. She's never doing just one thing, always at minimum of two. She's very headstrong, but she has issues with the females in this world, so she's going to be doing much better when she plays with the men. She needs to play with boys. It makes her much stronger and much more into who she is because she's very creative. She's not afraid of working with anything in any way, shape, or form, but this young lady wants her personal freedom, and she wants it perfectly. You know, some people just want freedom, but she has this agenda in her own mind of how perfect it's supposed to be, and she will work to the her fingers can happen in that direction, which
oh
is great.
Goodness. So she sounds like quite a little powerhouse, and she certainly comes across that way in her role on the screen, the Doctor Who.
Well, I think the part that's very interesting is that she has a true destiny in this lifetime where she's here to help everybody else make it over the hurdle, but it's issues with females that will either make it or break it for her. So she's going to be one of these behind-the-scenes kind of prodding the men along to get them to do what the woman needs them to do.
Oh, my goodness. Well, she's a force to be reckoned with. There's no question about it.
That is a for sure. Also, though, I noticed one thing that I kept picking up in a couple of places, and I hope it isn't true, but they said something about the possibility that maybe she may be leaving after Christmas.
Well, you know, they love to move people around. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, they regenerate the doctor, and then we have a new doctor, and they change the companion out. And yeah, they have a lot of... I can't stand it. You know, all these changes. I just get into these characters and like to watch them and follow them, and then the next thing I know, they're changing them out again. So,
well, the neat thing about this is because she's such a strong individual, she's going to go nowhere but up with the choices she makes.
Well, that's
so
good. You know, it's
they'll
the role
do her
of
a
lifetime.
Favor if they move her. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's being on this show and being associated with this legendary series is such a career boost.
Oh,
and
definitely.
Yes. So I can imagine wherever she goes from here, it'll be up and it'll be good because, again, she started out very strong in this role. And it's wonderful to watch her. She's a great character on the screen, and she does well with the new Doctor Who, Peter Capaldi, who was excellent last week. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens as the weeks unfold. So tell
definitely.
Me, now today, tell both Helene and I about 27. Today's a 27-day. Oh, it seems like today was very busy for been packed full of stuff for both Helene and I.
It is with everyone. You have to remember that the day and the month are identical. So you're getting a double whammy of everything that's happening, the good, the bad, the oh, my gosh. So it happens to be, it's a sixth universal month, which is all about perfection, family, wanting things taken care of, everything from issues with our pets to trying to do things in a hurry and trying to take care of our, shall we say, our health side, but more of the not the technical health, but taking a look at things from a different angle. So everybody wants to have this warm, fuzzy part of their lives taken care of, but at the same point in time, they want it perfect. And they can't volunteer for anything today, because if they do, they're going to find that their little nose is going to get bent out of shape, because it's a time, if you're asked, you do what is asked of you, but if you volunteer, I can guarantee you something will go wrong with it, and you sit there with your nose against the glass going, now how did I do this?
Ooh. Mm. Today is the day of caution.
Oh, most definitely, because we all want things to be perfect, and we obligate ourselves in a way to this responsibility in making decisions that sometimes we jump in before we have a chance to see everything that's laid out in front of us, because that wanting that perfect, and besides that, that's also going to have a bit of a pull on us when it comes to relationships, friendships, partnerships, and or those that we're trying to move out of our lives. Those will all have an impact on us. But most importantly, there's going to be, pay attention to your pets today. They're telling you a lot. They're showing you a lot. They may be acting out, or they may be somewhat reserved in staying away from what's going on around you, but they're feeling a lot of what's taking place. This is all about alternative health things as well. So it's a pretty full day.
It sure is. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, we've been forewarned, forearmed, and we don't have really too much left of the day. I think that's good.
That's right.
What do you think, Lee?
Well, do you think I made some decisions today that I should have waited on?
Well, but the thing is, you get a chance to review, rethink, and remember tomorrow when you lay things out. Tomorrow it's going to be about thinking and planning. Please don't do. Use it as your guide to get everything laid out. The doing will be done on Friday.
Okay.
Oh, thank you for that.
I'm going
to
keep you all out of harm's way, because if you are in good spirits and shape, so will I.
Oh, boy. Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, this is a lot to take in, so we'll let that sit for a minute. Really, really. That's how I feel about this whole week. It's just been, like, very similar to this day, but very packed.
It is.
So, well, thank you, Patricia. Thank you so much for your insight on Clara and also on our day tomorrow and Friday, what's coming up. I mean, it just all sounds like we need to sit down with you and map out the next 6 months so we know what to do. So, hey, everybody, if you want a reading with Patricia Kirkman, she does private readings, and she can help you map your life out through the numbers. You can find Patricia at patriciakirkman.com. So, all right. Well, thank you again, Patricia.
You're more than welcome. Now we're on with William.
Now we're on with Mr. Bill. Okay, we're going to bring him right on. And, again, this is a fabulous book. And Bill Hall, he was born and raised in Bridgeport, Connecticut, where the events of this book took place. He actually watched the news coverage of the Lindley Street haunting on television when he was 10 years old. After more than 25 years as a professional magician, Mr. Bill Hall knows how to create and recognize illusions. He is experienced in researching the unexplained, from folklore to fortune telling. His syndicated 1990s column, Magic and the Unknown, ran for 6 years in multiple local papers in his home state. Bill, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What a story you've written about here. My goodness.
Oh, thank you. And thanks to the other Patricia, now I know I don't have to do anything tomorrow, so that's great.
That's right. That's why people
got out of it.
Listen to our show.
I'll do anything tomorrow. You know? No, but thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, walk us through this, Bill, because now we understand you saw this on the news when you were 10, but what is it that made you take up this story and research it so thoroughly as an adult? What drew you back to this?
Yeah, that's a funny story, and it's one of those things that just started small and just kept getting bigger until it exploded. I was having coffee, doing what any intellectual would do in the morning, having coffee, reading the Wall Street, being on Facebook, and I saw a post in one of the Bridgeport community groups. This lady posted, "Does anybody remember the haunted house on Lindley Street?" And it occurred to me that was one incident that I never really looked into in depth. You know, talked about a little bit. You know, saw it on the news, asked my dad. You know, I don't remember what I saw on the news, but I remember watching it, and because it was on for a few nights there, and my dad said, "No, it's not real." And you know, life goes on. You're 10 years old, you know. But I saw it on Facebook, and I said, "Well, I never really got the whole story to it." And so I did some Googling, and after I ended up reading 40, 50 newspaper articles, I was convinced that there was, no matter what happened, there definitely was a great story there. Obviously, if it was fake or something else, it wouldn't be a book, but there definitely seemed to be a lot of witnesses that were very credible, and I felt it really was definitely worthy of further investigation. So I started writing down all the names that I saw in the newspapers, and I found Joe Tomek, who was one of the first responding police officers, and had a great interview with him, and he told me he was forced to be interviewed by these investigators after it was all over in a conference room set up at the police station. So I found that to be pretty fascinating.
And
who was
interviewing him?
It was he didn't know who it was, so I didn't know at that time, but I ended up seeing the newspaper the name Boy Spady, and he was the lead investigator on the case. And he ended up calling. He was actually going to call Bill Roll, William Roll, as I'm sure you know who he is, from Duke University, and he was away in England at the time. So two other guys from students came from Duke, Jerry Sulfin and Keith Harari, and so the three of them did the investigation, and. So I got a hold of Boy Spady. He was living in the same town as in 1974, very easy to find. And I called him up and said, asked him if I can talk to him about the case. And he gladly talked about it. And then I said, "Well, you know, Joe said that there were all of these files and tapes and, you know, that there was this big investigation. Do you know where any of these interviews are?" And he said, "Yeah, I do." And I said, "Well, where are they?" And he goes, "Well, they're in a box in my basement."
So, oh, my goodness.
And that's the way it started. He invited me over his house and gave me a report to read while he read the newspaper. And I, you know, he said, "Go ahead and read this and look through these materials. And when you're done, then we'll start." And so I did. And I highlighted some stuff and made some notes. And then we talked and went through the case. I left with bags full of cassettes and a reel-to-reel, and I started the long journey of listening to them, not knowing what I was going to find. And, boy, I'll tell you, I listened to nothing else but those interview tapes. I mean, because there was hours, and there's about 30 hours of interviews, so it was all I was listening to. I was listening to them in the car. I was listening to them, you know, it was everywhere I went.
Now, as you were immersed, and you truly were immersed in this case, did you have any paranormal experiences during this time? Did you feel that just listening to these tapes was opening the door up again on any of this?
They weren't scary or anything, but I had a few occurrences that, you know, at the beginning I thought nothing of it until... other people I gave the tapes to for translation purposes were coming across the same trouble. So one of the tapes I listened to, Boy Spady came on and said that he had, you know, that an entire side of interviews did not record with the family and they had to do them all over. And he said that was, strange. And I remember I heard that relatively early, and I'm like, "Oh, come on!" You know, I'm thinking, why would you think that? You know, it just seemed. But he didn't say that it was from that. He was basically documenting it and making a note. You know, so I mean, it was a good thing to do. So, I've had computer problems before, but these were not the regular, you know, build computer problems or regular computer things. It was the audio was being lost by different, I mean, these were entirely different people that were translating it, and they would say that they translated it and the sound was there, and then the audio clip was gone. And they managed to translate, you know, part of it or most of it, but this was happening with entirely different people, and it happened to myself also. So I didn't, you know, is it paranormal? I mean, I don't know, but it certainly was much more unusual than just a normal, you know, it wasn't like my computer malfunctioned, then I'd say, oh, well, you know, what else is new? You know, this was
right.
a very weird thing that happened particular to those tapes. And some people even gave it back to me saying that they didn't want to translate it once they heard what it was about. But
well, this case, how long did you actually investigate it? I mean, did you do this for months, years? How long did it take you to really wrap your mind around it and start writing the story?
Well, I did it on two tracks. So I was listening to the interview tapes, and then after that, it was the next step was doing my own interviews and expanding that research to find out, you know, who else is there that knows. You know, today with social media, as you know, I feel it definitely was possible that I can come across people who are children or, you know, others that maybe were mentioned in the interviews but weren't specifically interviewed themselves, and also reconnect with the people who were originally interviewed that are still with us and have a follow-up interview to kind of see, you know, what their experience and recollections and things like that are now. So the process was first to listen to the tapes, then it was to build a timeline, because it's like a soap opera, you know.
so going on in this house.
Yeah, so you had to map that all out. And then after that, I did start some of the writing, but at the same time I was writing, I was on two tracks, so I was writing parts as I was interviewing new people. And, I mean, I kept interviewing people right up to when I was submitting, you know, the manuscript, only till I was convinced that nobody else was going to come forward, at least not with new information, you know. I'm sure there will be as this goes on, because, you know, this thing has legs and, you know, it's certainly was very public. But so it was interesting to, you know, I was going on those two tracks. And there were some times I would finish an interview and have to go back to my manuscript and say, oh, I got to add that detail in, because maybe I didn't learn anything new, but they happened to share a little detail that really added something nice to it, you know, something they saw in the crowd, or, you know, just little details to try to get it as full of a story as I could, because nothing in the book is made up at all. So I'm constrained by the truth in a way, because if they didn't give the detail, then I don't have it. I mean, I looked up the weather and stuff, and, you know, but, you know, nothing is made up. So luckily, there was so many witnesses and so many interviews that there were a lot of little details that were kind of thrown in there. You know, five people explaining the same thing, and, you know, somebody finally says that the jar that they were walking around with was, you know, a coffee can, or, you know, just little details that add to it. So that was kind of the writing process. But, yeah, I kept interviewing till the last minute, because I, you know, I had to, just to make sure somebody didn't come in with, you know, something that was really different or that really added to the story. So and there were some ones that came in later that were, you know, that were really nice and big finds.
Well, this whole story, again, is just, I mean, layer upon layer of information. And the way you've written this book, it does grab you. And I couldn't put it down, because you just kept building on it, building and building on exactly what happened. Now, also, I knew Boyce Beatty years ago when I lived in Connecticut. And
oh, wow, yeah.
And
yeah,
I know for a fact that Boyce must have kept really good notes for you.
Oh, my. Let me tell you, as a magician, my big fear was that the interviews were going to be in such a way that you still wouldn't know what happened. You know, because there's what somebody says happens, you know, how they experience it or perceive it, and then what are the actual details. So if you say the table floated or, you know, whatever you say, what does that mean? Did one side pick up first? You know, are we going to get to that level of detail so we knew exactly what happened? Well, no worries with Boyce.
Right.
He would stop people. Oh, wait, you know, don't go further. Let's concentrate on that chair. When you say the chair lifted, what part lifted? What did you see lift? How did it lift? How fast did it lift? Did it lift?
Thank goodness. That's how he was. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did it come down in such a way that gravity would have pulled it, or was it slower than gravity or faster than gravity? You know, I mean, he was just, when I was hearing him, I'm like, oh, this is wonderful. You know, because
yes.
There really wasn't much that I would have added. And I was really hoping that we had that level of detail so that we all knew, you know, what really happened, you know, in that kind of detail.
Well, please walk us through the story, if you would. I mean, this is really, I mean, I also have to tell you, I really felt for Marcia, the little girl who was adopted. I mean, my heart just broke for her in what she was experiencing. But if you can set the stage for our audience, if you would, and give us all just kind of a look into what was happening in this family and how they came to adopt Marcia.
Sure. So we have a maintenance man, you know, a simple man, a very holy man, a holy family, actually. Both were very devout Catholics. The old school Catholicism based more on, you know, fear than love, although I think right during those times it was during almost a transition to that, like Father Charbonneau, who was one of the investigators who came with the Warrens at the time, had mentioned in the interview that you know, the church has been changing funerals to be more of a celebration than, you know, a mourning. So, you know, so you can hear from some of the things that were said, me not being a historian, but, you know, that things were in a transition, but they were still more of that old school Catholicism, very religious, went to church, knew the priest. Matter of fact, Jerry, the father, was an altar boy. He was going to become a priest. He ended up going into service, and, you know, the depression hit and stuff. So we have Jerry and Laura, his wife, Laura Gooden. And mm-hmm. By the time this happens, they're middle-aged. But they have earlier when they, in the late 1960s, mid to late, they have a son, Jerry Jr., who has cerebral palsy and he can't walk or talk or eat or do anything himself. And they had to do everything for him. And they took care of him and, you know, gave him as full of a life as they could. And
which is it must have been all encompassing. And I'm not a mother, but Helene, you are. I mean, can you imagine what it was like having to take care of a child who was in that kind of a situation?
Totally disabled. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, yeah. Had to be.
It's a lot of love, but it's also heartbreaking for them. You know, you want your children to be healthy and well. Yeah.
It's depressing, it's angering, you know, it's anybody I think who knows or has a special needs child will, you know, it runs the gamut of the emotions, you know,
mm-hmm.
And of course a lot of work and a lot of love and that sort of thing. But and so he dies in 1967, and, you know, he's only 6 years old, and they're devastated, and they set up a little shrine in the house, and they go to the graveyard every day. Finally, they decide to adopt, because Laura had a hysterectomy, because they found a tumor, so she had that done. And they ended up adopting Marcia, a little girl who was from Ontario, Canada, and she was Five Nations Indian. We don't know that much about the background other than that it was a family of nine. She was the only one given up for adoption. Evidently, she was tied to a chair, but we don't really know if that was, you know, how abusive that was or if it was too much for the family to handle or if perhaps maybe there was a poltergeist situation there that ended up following. Or, you know, we don't really know that much about that. That would be interesting, but, you know, that part of the story we don't really know. And no one in the family really knew. And I don't think they shared that much with the Goodens either. I mean, the Goodens, when they were talking about it, talked about it as if it was abuse, but of, you know, not really knowing and nine children, I mean, you know, I don't know. Who knows, you know?
Yeah, you're right. It's hard to even speculate as to what this was about.
Yeah, I don't like to do the cut and dry thing because, you know, we don't really know the details. And boy, you know, the one thing you learn going through a case like this is the story is very different when you have the details. You know?
It really is, isn't it? But this was the real deal. I mean, so here, now you pronounced her name Marcia. I'm sorry, I pronounced it Marcia. So Marcia was the only one of these nine children that was given up for adoption. And was it that she was she taken out of the home by social services to be given up? Is that how
well,
it went?
Well, that we don't know. You know,
you
the
don't
adoption
know
agency.
Okay.
Yeah, the adoption agency in Stanford just said they had a child, you know, and they had matched the two because Laura was a Bohemian and Cherokee Indian, so they thought it was a good match, and that's all they really knew. And so Marcia
Are you
is
picking up anything on this one, on this part of it? I'm just very curious.
It's really
about
hard because what I got from the whole story that was really that all of this stuff was coming through Marcia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she clearly was the focus, regardless of what anyone believes. You know, is. The cause of the phenomena. You know, there's all different theories, of course, but she definitely was a focal point of it all.
And how old was she when she was adopted, did you say? Six or something like that?
She was four and a half.
Four and a half. Okay, so she's taken out of her home, away from her family and her siblings, and brought to this new family. How distressing that must have been.
Yeah, she was very happy, though. By all counts, she was happy, but she was very shy, and she actually was doing pretty good in the Catholic school she went to, and then the father's hours got cut back. He was a maintenance man, and she had to go to public school, and yeah, it was a little bit of a rough neighborhood and rough school at the time, and they picked on her, boys and girls, you know, every day. Because of the color of her skin, you know, the olive color, and after about a year of being picked on, meanwhile, I should back up, meanwhile, not only is she being picked on at school, but to add to it, the parents are completely overbearing and sheltering and, you know, basically raising her like they were raising Jerry, you know, not letting her, oh, she can't cross the street, she's going to die. You'll see that
in the
book, in the transcript, you know, everything was, she's going to die, she's going to get killed, you know.
No, there was a big import of energy from their end.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, there was plenty of turmoil and stuff going on, even without a poltergeist. But, and that definitely was something they had to deal with. So then she gets beat up at school.
So when she comes home, she got beat up and it's terrible. Things are getting worse, obviously, at school, not better. And is this when
Well, I'm sorry?
Is this when the poltergeist activity started?
Well, actually, things started right after they had, pretty soon after they adopted her.
Right then. So right at 4 and a half years old.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Slow, you know, kind of like a slow burn kind of thing, as these things sometimes happen. You know, just seeing the door move a little bit and keys misplaced and chair out of order, you know, the type of thing where Jerry thought, you know, am I going crazy or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
But it is true that the culmination of these things ended up with the big activity, you know, when the big activity started. And, you know, the bigger kinds of things started more in 1971 when the maddening knocking and banging on the outside and insides of the wall that, you know, would follow the family room to room and, you know, follow the mother and mostly the mother and daughter. But, of course, they were the ones who were home most of the time. So, you know, it's hard to say that whether or not that's a standout thing or just because they happen to be home. And of course, you know, now Marcia is stuck at home with the overbearing mother after getting beat up at school for 6 weeks. That's enough to drive people crazy. And so this thing really hits ahead. But in 71, they hear these knocking sounds and, you know, they complain to the police and the town hall and everything. And nobody could figure out what the sounds are, and you know they have all sorts of people come in. And in 1972, and it was every November they were hearing these sounds on and off. So in 72, their neighbor, who's a police officer, and their neighbor and friend, who's a police officer, Officer John Holsworth, across the street, he says, Jerry, why don't we record the sounds so that you know the town and the police could figure out what the noises are. So they recorded the sounds. And in fact, later on, the lieutenant had verified that Jerry did call them about these sounds years before. Because, you know, a lot of people would say later, oh, well, this is because of the exorcist. They just want, you know, they just were trying to capitalize off of that or whatever. But, you know, this
right.
had started years before with the family. It's just that it didn't go public and didn't really culminate until November 74, you know, when it really... when it was the big outbreak, if you will. And
now, so you're bringing us up to date with the smaller stuff first, so seeing a door open or seeing something small moved around, but then, as you say, it started to ramp up. And what were some of the events that occurred that were particularly interesting with this experience of this poltergeist energy?
Well, when it was ramping up at the start, one of the really interesting ones was the window shattered from the inside, but not the outside for no reason. So, and you know, of course, I didn't know why that happened. And there was another family member and a child there and everything, and, you know, they had witnessed that happen, didn't know what happened. And then the family also saw a disembodied hand out the window. And, of course, then they got closer and nothing was there, and they heard a knock on the door, and there were wet footprints on, and it was a dry night. So just weird things like that. But then it really culminated when they went away to New York, which they used to do every other week, and upstate New York, and they'd see Jerry's brother and go to church and grocery shopping, and they came home and saw Marcy's TV had fallen off the high shelf. They didn't know how it got there, a little puzzling, but, you know, not going to cry ghost or anything. So he puts it back up, and it falls again, and meanwhile, he's getting the groceries. He disconnects the TV because it fell twice. And then he is out getting the groceries. Meanwhile, the mother is in the kitchen with a few bags of groceries. And the table flips, throwing the groceries all over. And then this giant TV, one of those giant heavy console TVs they used to have in the 1970s, falls over and actually breaks her toe. So all this stuff is going on. The couches are opening and closing and hopping, and they were these, not couches, recliners. They're these three really heavy recliners. I equate them to now, I think, the only recliners that are heavy like that, and probably not even as heavy, are the ones that lift you up, you know, the ones that have the motors and the metal in them, you know.
Yeah.
Really heavy back then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were doing those things, and that's when the family went on the porch hysterical and got the attention of Officer Holsworth's daughter and said, go get your dad because, you know, we're in trouble here. And that's when he came in, and then he saw a bunch of stuff happen, including the refrigerator floating, and the family was still on the porch, and he saw all this stuff. Did I give you a recording by any chance? I
have a recording here, and it's of one of the witnesses, I believe. Is it a police officer that was speaking in this?
Yes, because we're up to a good time when we can play Officer John.
I'd be
John
happy
Holsworth.
To play it. I mean, hopefully it loaded properly onto the board. I know there's a few seconds at the very beginning that we can ignore, but then you begin to hear somebody talking about what happened. So do you want me to play that now, Bill?
Yeah, that's Officer John Holsworth, and he's interviewed a little bit later in the day, and he describes what happened when the Goodens called for him from the porch.
Okay, let's see if this is...
Gerald Mary... Gerald Gooden?
Yeah.
Mary is good.
He doesn't want to be in there.
Okay. Now, this tape is distorted. Okay.
I'm at 975 Lunar Street.
And you're with the Bridgeport Police Department?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell me, did you respond to the call?
Yes, I did. My daughter was walking the dog, and she ran into the house and said, Jerry and Laura, which we know them by, had an emergency when I come right over. I come over and found the two of them on the porch hysterical.
And what did you find when you came into the house?
I come in, I found everything array. I mean, just disarray. The table's over, the chair's over, the icebox moved, the television moved, and I was the only one in the house, and they were still on the porch.
Did you actually see anything move yourself?
Yes, I did. I just told you. I saw the icebox move, I saw the television move, I straightened the television, it turned around, I saw the chairs open and close.
Was there any other phenomenon that you observed?
Nothing else other than selling the people down.
I said, did you also see the cat?
No, the cat was not around.
Okay. And did you also witness the little girl in the chair that was pushed back in the front room? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I did. I seen her fly back 3 or 4 times. This later on in the afternoon. I left and come back and saw this.
And do you, did you test the chair to see whether it was possible that, that the girl could do it herself?
No, there was no way. There was a priest here at the time when I returned from across the street who tried it himself, as big as I am. I'm 6'2". I weigh 220 pounds. And he couldn't move it. And she just flew back like there was nothing.
Have you ever been involved in any psychic phenomenon before in your years on the police force?
15 years, no.
Nothing. What was your belief in hauntings and poltergeist activity before? You probably heard about it. What's your belief now?
I thought it was a poltergeist right away when I thought about it. And I believe in this, but I don't follow it.
I see.
Anything can happen.
I see. So you were surprised. I mean, you came to this believing that it could happen.
Oh, everything can happen. Anything can happen.
Mm-hmm. How was this reported in the police department? What kind of a report would be turned in?
I don't know. I have to make a report myself. I was called by the Lieutenant Coco, Bridgeport Police Department, who observed and controlled the scene here today.
I see. Did he observe any phenomenon, you know?
I don't know. Other officers at the scene, I had to make my report, like I say, and get names of the other officers who did observe.
Were there many officers who observed?
There was 10 or 12.
10 or 12. And also, I believe there were firemen also.
Firemen also, right. Firemen were here. It was 10 firemen, 2 chiefs.
And they observed the phenomenon that actually had seen things happen.
I don't know what their activity was. I wasn't here. I was across the street watching my baby when the firemen arrived. But they walked out of here and they were afraid.
I see. Thank you very much, officer.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Quite an audio clip. Thank you so much for sharing that
with you're welcome.
All of us. Oh, my goodness me. So, that was a great interview. You asked wonderful questions and very piercing questions of him, but clearly he saw these things moving around the house. He saw it himself.
Well, one of the best, probably the best evidence you can ever hope for is Marcy was sitting in a recliner with her legs crossed and her hands on her lap, and the recliner lifted in the air and did a flip, and that was while three police officers were talking to her and there were firemen in the room, and knowing Boyce Beatty, he had each of them individually describing the events, and also had them charted on a model of a home as to where everybody was. So it's very rare that you have this kind of documentation where you have multiple people describing the same incident from different vantage points, and being able to compare all those stories and seeing how they all saw the same things. It's not like, maybe you didn't quite see it right. No, we're talking about multiple people, and, we're not talking about people who were drinking or who were, they were looking right at her, and, and it's great in the interview.
These are professionals. These are police. These are firemen that are giving their account of what they saw, which was quite amazing. And also, here's my question. How was Marcy doing through all this? Was she scared? Was she crying? Was she quiet?
Well, that surprised everybody that she was, it didn't seem to faze her as much. There were times when, when she'd have the initial shock or the initial scream, but then other than that, she really didn't care as much and went back to, watching cartoons and that kind of thing. The other thing is she did really like the attention of people in the house because of being so sheltered. And, when you get to hang out with the police all day, and when things quiet down, they leave. So, yeah, she did a few things, but, those things didn't fool anybody,
Mm-hmm.
But later on, of course, in the retelling, it's when you don't have the details, it's easy to sell anything to the public. But, I call this the Roswell of, haunted houses because it's something that exploded and went around the world. Got much bigger than these things usually ever get. Certainly there are some exceptions where things get this big, but it not only got huge and had thousands of people outside the house and traffic blocked and the roads closed and, it was just crazy. And then on top of that, having the amount and type of witnesses, and then add to that a thorough investigation and documentation, and that to me is what enamored me to the case.
It is just incredible, and the amount of power, the amount of energy that it would take to move these heavy objects like this. You're just not talking about moving a recliner a couple inches or slamming a door. You're talking about this thing rising up into the air and flipping. These recliners back then were very heavy.
Yeah. It took multiple witnesses describe after that one police officer went to right the chair, and he couldn't. Another one had to join in to help him so that he could bring the chair back to its regular position. So, that's how heavy these things were. Definitely, it was definitely at its height then. And the same thing with a refrigerator, what they estimated, that was about a 300-pound refrigerator. And, for that thing to move and go across the floor and that kind of thing is, that was another thing that was quite fascinating.
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say the the entities also picked up and, you know, threw Marcy against the wall. So there's a lot going on in there.
Haven't there been a lot of studies of telekinesis with children, though, over the years? That there are children who are such open energy fields or have portals or whatever you want to call it, that they are actually able to subconsciously use their will to move objects and extend that energy far, far away from themselves?
That is one of the theories, and I believe that was what Boyce, and I don't know Jerry back then if he believed the same thing, but I know that was Boyce's theory back then, the RSPK, the recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis.
Mm-hmm.
There were many things that happened when Marcy wasn't in the home at all. And the other thing that makes me, and again, I'm, you know, who's to say? I'm not, you know, somebody has a different theory. I'm not going to argue with them. I'm just happy people are thinking about it, you know.
Right,
but,
yes.
I think the entities throws a wrench in, well, perhaps, again, you know, anything's possible. You know, we make a lot of assumptions, and I'm no different. But, Paulino's, when the entity rubbed against him as it went around him to get Marcy and pick her up and throw her against the wall, him describing and feeling that this thing had a bone structure was, that blew his mind, because he was like the Warrens. I mean, he had the, you know, the demonology mindset,
mm-hmm.
and he felt and saw this thing as a physical being, and that threw him for a wrench. I mean, he didn't even mention it. He didn't mention it for many, many years until probably started talking about it like about 5 years ago, and people would have thought he was nuts. You know, especially he was 21 years old at the time, and he didn't want to go tell Ed and Lorraine that, hey, you know, did you know this thing has bone structure?
Yeah. And they can really be that way. They really can.
Now, do you think, Helene, do you think it was a demonic force? Are you picking up on that? What are your thoughts?
It was a portal that came through the child, is what I'm getting. And I don't know why that opened in her or was with her, whether she brought it in or whether her past abuse and different things in the house, you know, the former family she was in, caused her to open that level of energy. And then it brought in entity. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Like a double thing is what I'm getting.
Yeah,
it's almost like, it definitely fits the bill with, it was a perfect storm, obviously perfect storm with the family, you know, and certainly could have been with Marcy's prior situation. And also Bridgeport itself, you know, it had the underground spring, it had the sandy soils, high water tables, you know, that whole electromagnetic right for that, which Bridgeport, in fact, has a lot of paranormal activity. So, I mean, it just like I've heard under power lines, sometimes you see that that's a correlation. Again,
mm-hmm.
I don't think it's any one of these things, but certainly they certainly had a perfect storm of things that
I am picking up that her original biological family was afraid of her.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, that could have been.
They were afraid of her. They were very clear that whatever activity was going on around her was coming through her, and they were simply in fear, and that with so many people in the house and so many children, they just didn't know what to do. This wasn't a hurtful family, the way I'm getting it. It's that they were trying to protect her and the other children, and they didn't know what was going on, and they put her up for adoption. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would be logical, because...
Yeah. There was a lot of fear around this girl.
And those people usually aren't, I mean, they're peaceful people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not, I guess anything's possible, but you know what I mean. They, it's not like, oh, that tribe is known for that kind of stuff. You know, no,
right.
They're peaceful,
right.
Peaceful people.
And did anyone ever find her biological family later, in later years?
No. No, I don't even know if the biological family was ever revealed to her. Now, I know Marcy had left to go find them. So, you know, whether she located them or ended up wanting to or whatever, you know, that we don't know. But
goodness me, what a great, great job you've done bringing this story back to us. Bill, what a great book. And again, the name of this book is The World's Most Haunted House, The True Story of the Bridgeport Poltergeist on Lindley Street. The book is available for all of you who I know are going to run out and buy it. It is on Amazon.com. We're going to take a very short commercial break, so stay tuned, everyone. We've got questions coming in the chat room that we're going to be asking Bill, and also just continue this very, very fascinating conversation about this world's most haunted house. So stay tuned, everyone. We'll be right back.
Your property tax bill. Have you seen it lately? It's frightening. Your property taxes are going up while your home value is going down. It's time to fight back and win. For the real truth about the property tax system, get attorney Pat Quintilian's book, Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Attorney Quintilian answers all your questions and gives you the facts you need to fight a property tax bill that is spiraling out of control. You'll also read about what happens to property owners who don't check their property records, only to find out too late they're taxed on square footage, fixtures, and even buildings that they don't own. Is this happening to you? Learn your rights. Buy Attorney Pat Quintilian's book today. Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Available on Amazon.com.
Bonjour, this is Véronique Raskin, founder of the Organic One Company. As one of the pioneers of the Organic One movement, since 1980, I have brought you the very best and most authentic organic wines directly to your table. I work with small family estates who grow certified organic grapes and produce exceptional wines. You can purchase our wines individually from our website at theorganicwinecompany.com or join one of our wine clubs. Our organic wines are perfect for you and for your family as gifts for friends and relatives, and they are simply spectacular for the holidays. Visit us at theorganicwinecompany.com to enjoy the very best organic wines conveniently delivered to your door. I am Véronique Raskin, passionate about my mission. I offer to you vegan, organic, and biodynamic wines, wines made by people of the heart, wines with a heart. Au revoir. Call us at 1-888-ECO-WINE.
Are you ready for a new experience of freedom and powerful connection? Would you like a positive, effortless change in your life? Then come to CosmicFusion.com, where we offer the most advanced energy clearing and expansion techniques in the world, with a quantum vortex energy to activate your divine blueprint and life's purpose. When your soul leads the way with cosmic fusion and quantum vortex energy, you can break clear of past difficulties and blocks with the power of the source. With Cosmic Fusion, the source energy does the work for you. It's easy and effortless. Listen to our free meditation right from our Cosmic Fusion website, the Cosmic Code Meditation. Sign up for one of our interactive webinars today. Come to Cosmic Fusion, www.kosmicfusion.com, to experience an effortless awakening and transformation. Are you ready for an upgrade? Are you ready for a new experience of living in the fifth dimensional magic and powerful connection? Then visit CosmicFusion.com today. CosmicFusion.com.
having a great discussion tonight about the world's most haunted house, the true story of the Bridgeport Poltergeist on Lindley Street, written by Bill Hall, available on Amazon.com. Great book. Just an amazing, amazing story. Bill, I've got a question from the chat room for you. Somebody wants
Great.
To know why they didn't leave the house. I mean, if they were, they may not have been associating this stuff with the house, but it sounds like it's a good, fair question to ask.
Yes. Well, during the height of this, there were a lot of people at the house, but they did leave the house many times. They stayed with family. In fact, there was one interview where it's being relayed where family had called, and the boy picks up and says, "Ma, it's Jerry, Laura, they're coming back over," you know. So they had really a whole new normal, if you will. I mean, they were staying with family a lot. There was one night where they decided not to go somewhere else, and they all slept in the living room instead of in the bedrooms. There were times where one of the nights they had asked their neighbor, the officer John Holdsworth, to stay there with them. That was during one of the beginning during that height of the phenomena, and he slept on a couch and stayed with them till like 5 a.m. or something. So there was a lot of things going on. Also, Jerry, the father, got in the practice of when they got home, he would go in first and go around the entire house seeing what happened while they were out and before the family went in. So, I mean, they had a whole new normal established because of this. So, yes, they did leave the house many times, and sometimes they did stay there. There were a lot of people that were staying with them, police officers and the Warrens and Paulino and Father Charbonneau were there quite a bit, many, many hours in and out, you know, during the day, during the height of it. But it did continue afterwards, and they spent more time. And actually, by the time Boyce Beatty had contacted them to start the investigation, which was now in December, like December 18th it started, they had things packed. I mean, they were ready to leave. And they were told that, you know, if they left, this thing would follow them. The Warrens told them that. You know, Boyce had explained that that was most likely the situation, that they had to resolve, you know, the issues as a family in order, you know, for this thing to stop. And but they were at the point where they said, you know, all right, well, whatever, we're getting out of here. And it wasn't even just the house. I mean, yes, it was what was happening, but it was also just the crowds, the people at work. I mean, he couldn't work there because of the ridicule at his maintenance job. I mean, it was just their whole life. They just wanted to get away from it. So there was a lot of things going on. So they were ready to go, and they did end up putting the house up for sale and couldn't sell it. You know, and then eventually things had calmed down when, you know, Marcy got settled back in school and stuff. But I guess that's the long-winded answer to that. I think, or I hope the book does a good job of that. You can see the progression and how things happen. And what impressed me is a lot of what they did was very much behind the public eye. You know, the public didn't see what they were doing. They weren't doing it for show. They were trying to live, but yeah, there was a lot of cases where, you know, they had plenty of people with them in the house, as well as, like I said, sleeping in the living room, going to the aunt's house many times. The brother went to the brother's, you know, so they were, and sometimes Jerry and Laura would stay in the house, and it was Marcy was the one who was staying with family. So there was stuff going on quite a bit while Marcy wasn't there for long periods of time, because they didn't want her to get hurt, and they didn't want to stay there, but they didn't want to be a, you know, they're good people, and they didn't want to be a burden to the family by staying there nonstop. I mean, they stayed with family enough, but so yeah, there was all those things going on. But yeah, Marcy was away from the house for quite a long time, staying with family. I mean, they obviously would go see her, but she wasn't even allowed back in the house until they can get things settled. So things were going on while she was gone for days. So
amazing. Now, here's some other questions coming up from the chat room for you. They want to know, when did it actually stop?
It stopped after Marcy went back to St. Patrick's School. So she did end up, because, you know, the parents were not going to send her back to Reed School, the public school where she got beat up. They said no way, because, of course, they were always scared of her getting killed anyhow, you know, and now she gets beat up. You can imagine, I mean, it would be horrible for any parent to experience that, but when you're them and you're already paranoid about about her getting killed just walking up the street to play with friends, you know, then you can imagine how devastating it was on them. But when she got back to St. Patrick's and settled in and was away from the mother 24/7, you know, which any child stuck at home like that and in that kind of situation is going to have a problem. And then, of course, she's healing from the, you know, the wounds from being beat up. I mean, it was just, you know, bad situation. But, yeah, that once things got back to normal, things were more peaceful, then it petered out and, you know, settled down.
That's good news.
Yeah.
I also just want to announce to everybody that we're doing live tweets throughout the show. So if you want to follow us on Twitter, please do so. We are at SupernaturalGLZ. So be sure to join us there as well as listening to the show. There's a lot of questions coming in on Twitter as well as in the chat room. So we have a lot of activity over the world's most haunted house. Goodness. Well, now, you also mentioned in the book Mary Pascarella. And I never knew Mary, but I knew of her. And as I recall, she was a very talented psychic. Is that true?
You know, I don't know. I mean, it would make sense because I know she was part of the center in Dixwell Avenue at the time. I didn't know it then, of course, because I was only 10, but I mean, you know, I mean, later on. I don't know, you know, about her own talents.
Okay, because I was just wondering if she had anything to say about this, because I know she was very perceptive. I saw some of the things that she had said about other people involved in this type of thing, so I wondered if she gave you any insight or if she had told anybody any insight that she had about this case.
She wasn't interviewed directly, but, you know, if you recall, she was trying to make Marcy attempt to move things with her mind, and, you know, Marcy got upset, and, you know, but... So she was trying that. That might give you an indication as to what she, you know, that she thought maybe Marcy was psychic, or, you know, had some of these powers, or was unconsciously making them manifest, that kind of thing. That would be my only insight there based on, you know, what she was doing with Marcy, you know. But she also was, she had seen... the Warrens at a lecture, and she's actually the ones who called the Warrens in.
A center point for a lot of people. I think, Helene, she also knew Andrea.
Oh, really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, she did. So here's another question for you from the chat room. Somebody would like to know, is Marcy still living?
You're going to have to read the book for that one, because some people got mad at me when I did say it on a show, because they're like, oh, you ruined the ending, but, you know.
Oh, okay. Well, go out and buy this great book, The World's Most Haunted House. Yeah, there you go. You want to know the answer to that one.
I do take people through the search for Marcy in the book, and I, you know, I don't like giving that as an answer, but that's the only reason.
That's
fine. You can tell them.
Yeah.
With the information, but, you know, that's kind of the one part that I got slack for, so I don't say it anymore. I didn't know somebody would, but were sending me messages saying, don't tell us the ending. I was like, that was weird. All right, but I don't know if there is an ending. You know, these things are, you know, when it's real life, it's not quite as tidy as that, right?
Here's another question, because she was Native American, Marcy was, and there's also a little piece in the book where you talk about how she would rock back and forth with her eyes closed, and that she was told to do that when she wanted to contact her grandfather. So
yes.
That is fascinating to me, because, I mean, as Helene and I know all too well, you know, when you start contacting one person, if you don't know the proper ways of doing this and protections and things like that, you can open up doorways and contact a whole bunch of people or things. And it's very difficult to control it once that door is open. But this is something that she did fairly regularly, right? She rocked back and forth with her eyes closed and reached out to her grandpa.
Yeah, and what that meant, I didn't say because I didn't know. You know, I just reported that observation, and that came from Rosemary, who was Marcy's only friend. The parents knew each other, and so that's where I got that from. And, of course, bear in mind, Rosemary was very small at the time. She was 10 when relating that. So, although on the other hand, you know, these are the kinds of events that are especially, you know, different than ordinary, you know, but that's a tough thing. Like I said, Rosemary's wonderful, and, you know, and she's not lying or anything. It's just, it's very difficult when we start taking too much testimony from somebody very young like that. That's the only person that observed that. I did put it in the book because I felt that it was descriptive enough where it really seemed like it was a good memory, you know, that it was solid. But I really tried to only put things in that I can get a lot of verification and collaboration with. But unfortunately, that was one of the little pieces of information that no one else really had. So.
Yeah, and without knowing about the whatever happened to Marcy, too. I mean, who knows? I mean, wouldn't you just love to speak to this woman and find out what it was like for her personally to be going through this?
Yes, and, you know, as you probably know, there's, you know, it's really kind of a no-win situation for her, just like any of these children that are involved in these kinds of things. There's only one case that I found where a child spoke as a grown-up, and that was in the Enfield poltergeist case. And I was shocked that, you know, that she did come out for an interview with Guideline Playfair, the investigator in the case. But that's very rare. Most of the time, even if they're tracked down, they have an established family life and job and everything, and a lot of times their spouses don't even know. You know, they just, I know of some cases where the children were sought out and found, and you know, they're now grown up and got very scared and kind of like, you know, get away from me, you know, to the investigators.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I understand, but get away from me. I got a life now, and, you know, I got a family, and I think there was two or three in my research where, you know, they basically said, you know, even my wife doesn't know about it. Even their marriage partner has no idea of what happened. That's at that particular point. Who knows? I don't know at what point in their marriage maybe eventually they would say that. But, you know, the way these things are, it's a difficult decision to share them because and there were people like that in Lindley Street where the husband went back and told the wife and kids, and, you know, and the wife didn't believe him. Not because he thought he was lying. You know, your first notion is, you know, you must have saw something wrong, or what's wrong with you, or, you know.
Yeah, this can't be. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
People don't want to raise up trauma all over again.
Yeah, it's really a no-win situation. Oh, you were the freak back then. Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what do you get out of it?
Exactly. And then if you do stand up and talk about it, then you run the risk of facing what lots of people do in this field who stand up and talk about a personal experience. Is people point their fingers at you and call you names or just tell you you're trying to make money from something. And I'm sure that this family also faced some of that, even though that absolutely was not the case. I mean, when you read through your wonderfully written book, you really do. I mean, I know we really got that feeling about these people. They were holy people. They prayed all the time. They went to church all the time. This was not something that they wanted in their lives, and they certainly didn't see dollar signs affixed to it.
No, definitely not. They of course lost most of what they owned, and you know, as the attorney said, he said, I was young and hungry, had all kinds of plans for them, and they wanted no part of it. They clearly wanted no part of it. And I know people do think that they wanted to make money, but it's like, think further. How do you make money? How do you make money off of it? You know, I mean, yes, okay, the Warrens gave lectures and made money. Yeah, all right, I get that. But when you're talking about a family, how do they make money? I mean, you know, okay, there's some ways to make money at it, but it's still, it's work if you're going to make money at it. I mean, you can go to conferences and tell your story or whatever, you know, but I mean, that's, I don't even know what kind they had in the 70s, but... Yeah, I mean, you know, the people saying, oh, they, you know, the Warrens paid them $1 million. And so I'm like, what? What a horrible investment it would have been, you know? And they certainly would have taken a lot less money. Probably could have paid them $200 now. But it's just, it's just ridiculous. But we all know how that goes. But what was really interesting is after it, you know, I wrote the book, it's coming out, and I'm at family gatherings, and I'm almost, you know, oh, you wrote it, what's the book about? And I'm like, uh-oh, all right, I got to preface it with I'm not in crazy, you know, you guys probably run into the, I'm not crazy. And then I tell them, they're like, oh, no, I know it's true. And they take me aside, and they tell me a story about their own experience. And these are people in my family that I have known for years, and, you know, And I'm like, how come you never told me that before? So you don't tell somebody unless you know that they believe or investigate or, you know, found out for themselves, because otherwise it's, you know, you're just an idiot. And that was, I guess, something that I was indoctrinated into that I didn't see coming. You know, just a lot of people that I knew, that I was very close to, even regular interaction, that kind of thing, and never ever shared that with me, and I understand why, but now we're sharing different stories with me, and that amazed me how, and you guys probably know this already, for me it was new, but to realize that this stuff is a lot more prevalent, but you're not going to hear about it as much if you're on the outside, so to speak. You're just not going to hear about it because nobody wants to tell you about it. It's a no-win situation for them.
It is a no-win situation. It's exactly right. But here, it's so nice, and Helene and I, we've talked about this a lot. It's a whole different world today where, you know, our tagline on the show is where paranormal is normal. And it does feel like there is a whole new climate where people can come together and talk about these things. That's one of the reasons for our show, is we're doing this because it is normal. It's normal to us. It's normal to a lot of people. And we want to see more of an atmosphere available where there's acceptance, there's a willingness to explore and talk about these things. It just makes sense.
Yeah, and, you know, it, regardless of what you believe about anything. I mean, and Jerry Sulfin, when I interviewed him, and he was one of the investigators, actually he was the guy who did all the hours at the police department. But, you know, he said something really neat to me. And And he said, you know, he said, with science, he said, everybody says they're investigating and researching, but so many just have closed minds and already made up their mind and then set out to prove it. And, you know, they just close their minds, and it's always a monologue then and never a dialogue. And you know, history has shown itself that we've always thought we knew more than we knew, and we always looked at ourselves as the center of everything. You know, I mean, that's pretty easy to notice, but it's interesting to think about. You know, everything revolves around us, literally, way back then, right? I mean,
right.
Literally, the Earth is the center. We're important. You know. We go to heaven, dogs don't.
There's just so much more out there, as you have very well documented in this book. I love what you said about this is the perfect storm. I so agree with you, because you had a very repressed couple who were very repressive with their child. And as Helene, I so agree with you, too, when you talked about that this girl was in a position in her family where they were scared of her. So it was the perfect storm where this total repression was happening. That energy had to go somewhere. And couple that with the fact she was a Native American, and she may have had, who knows, she may have been a descendant of shamans, of Native American healers, and had this special ability that she had no training for. But again, this energy had to go somewhere. So here it was manifesting in all these strange ways in the house, around her, and then when she wasn't there even, just that doorway was wide open.
Yeah, and there were houses that were affected, so, you know, at the same time. So... But,
I have another
know.
Question for you also, Bill, from the chat room. They want to know when either Marcy was out staying with other people or the whole family went and stayed with other people, did the phenomena happen at those other homes?
No. No, only happened at the that's not true that it only happened at the house. There were Paulino, the seminarian, and Father Charbonneau and the Warrens went back to the Warrens' house in Monroe. They had an entity or presence there that relatively quickly dissipated, but it followed them back. And then the other situation was when things were getting really hectic in the house, and the billowing smoke was growing and everything, and Paulino said, "Everybody outside." And the Warrens weren't there at the time, and so Paul took them all outside and went to the neighbors to use the phone to call the Warrens to let them know, hey, things have gotten a lot worse, and, you know, and so he went next door, and when he was outside, that's when there were dogs barking at the air and then ran away, and the same thing happened with cats, and, you know, like there was something there. And then when Paul got into the house, the neighbor's house, when they let him in to use the phone, there was a knock on the door, and the kid opened the door and said, "Nobody's there." And you know, Paul, being 21 years old, said, "You want to bet, kid?" And it was funny, because when Paul told me that when I interviewed him, and I said, it ended up the first time I didn't realize it, but he said, "Oh, no, I said that out loud." I was like, "Oh, you did?" I don't know. He was telling me, he was saying it to himself, you know. He said, "Oh, no, I said it out loud to him." You want to bet, kid?
Yeah.
Yeah, so those were two incidents. But as far as Marcy, no incidents ever happened when she was staying with other family. Yeah.
And here's another question for you from the chat room. They want to know, was there ever an exorcism done?
No. You know, the Warrens were trying to get one approved. Father Charbonneau and Father Doyle were trying to get, you know, were working on it. And it was not, you know, they wouldn't do it. And, of course, I'm sure, you know, with the crowd situation and it being just so big and popular, that I'm sure they wouldn't want to touch it, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they just towed the party line. Actually, Father Doyle towed the party line. He kept saying, you know, there's no reason to believe it's, you know, anything but normal. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, he's telling, you know, the good ones, and all the witnesses are saying it, not just the good ones. They're like, well, Father Doyle told us we should tell him, you know, when something else happens, and Father Doyle said it was an evil spirit, and Father Doyle said, you know. So all the witnesses are saying what Father Doyle said, but when Father Doyle was interviewed, he didn't say it was anything. You know, of course, I'm sure, you know, you don't want to get in trouble. Now, Father Charbonneau, nobody knows how he survived in his career as a priest, well-decorated. You know, I mean, if you go up to him, this is what happened, and this is paranormal, and this happens all the time. And, you know, he was in all the newspapers and everything, and no one could understand how he got away with just being so open about it. It really was something to behold, to, you know, all the articles with him in it and stuff, and instead his career just kept getting, you know, better, and, well, not career, but you know what I mean. His involvement as a priest was, you know, he had quite a decorated involvement in the military and whatnot. I mean, he was very, very, did very, very well and very impactful, and, you know, he was a great guy, but everybody shook their head when... When they're like, yeah, we don't know how he got away with that. So.
But that's good. I mean, that's, to me, that's just wonderful that he had the strength, this character, to tell the truth, that he really felt it was important enough to be honest about these things that were happening in the house and with that family. So, yeah, my hat goes off to him. That's a great guy.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, my goodness. Just such an incredible story. I want to see it on like a made-for-TV movie or something. It's just, you've done a wonderful job with this, Bill. Great book, great writing.
Thank you. Those are so nice.
Tremendous, tremendous. Helene, do you have any more questions for Bill?
I'm wondering, Bill, when you were collecting all the evidence and collecting all the documentation, were you able to feel the energy of this? Hello.
I mean, yeah, I would say not really. I mean, in a sense, it was the reason I'm sorry is just kind of a hard thing to answer. But I mean, I was intensely fascinated by being able to go back in time, if you will, to
well,
hear
that's
the
feeling the energy of it. And,
okay. Yeah.
You know,
it's
like
you, meant,
you know
oh.
you became like sucked into it, kind of fascinated and completely believing.
Oh my, yes.
There. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. And
yeah.
hearing the family talk about, you know, you feel like you got to know them, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and you know, but of course you couldn't talk to them. But boy, but other than that, it was really.
Well, I feel like you had visions around it. That while you were doing the research, you could actually picture this stuff going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty natural thing to try to picture it, and I had pictures of the inside, so it was, as between the data sheets and the audio and the photos of the inside of the house, I tried to, you know, follow along and see how it all fit together to make sure that I could write it properly. But, yeah, it was quite fascinating to be able to... you know, like I said, it was like, you know, going back in time. I mean, all those records and interviews preserved, and, you know, many of those people are no longer with us, so, mm-hmm. Including, of course, the, you know, the good ones, so.
Yeah. So are you still following up with more paranormal tales?
Yes, yeah. You know, there's one that possibly might be a second book. But Paul Eno has taken me under his wing, and we become great friends. And he's a real, you know, you can trust him. So, you know, you can disagree with a theory if you want to, but he's the real deal. And you know, things are a lot they go a lot quicker and smoother when, when you're, if you're going to research something and you're doing it with somebody that you know you can trust, that, of course, it eases the investigation quite a bit. So
it certainly does. Yes. Well, Bill, thank you so much for coming on Supernatural Girls. It's been a pleasure. And, again, we want to highly recommend your book, The World's Most Haunted House, The True Story of the Bridgeport Poltergeist on Lindley Street, available on Amazon.com. So, guys, go
and
back
in stores.
It's great. And what?
I said and in stores.
And in bookstores. That's right. There are still stores out there that sell books.
Yep.
So, yes.
Fine or poor books sold, yes.
Well, again, thank you, Bill. And we're going to also tonight announce the winner, the lucky winner, who is going to get a copy of your book, Bill. There is a winner. Yes, and he is going to get a copy of your book. He's been following us on Twitter and retweeting our tweets, and his name is Anthony Tarongo, if I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Anthony Tarongo, you are the winner of a copy of the book, The World's Most Haunted House, and we'll just get your address, and we'll make sure it's sent right out to you at the beginning of the week. So thank you, Anthony, for following us and retweeting us and being a member of our community. That's great. Thank you so much. And, Bill, good luck with all your projects. You're a great writer, and, gosh, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking about this exciting case.
You guys, you just keep saying I'm great. That's, you know, I could listen to you all night.
Oh, we
so
only
much.
Tell the truth, really. So
right.
Thanks so much, Bill. Take care, and thanks for coming
Thank you,
on
Bill.
The show.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Helene, what a great show, huh? What a great guest.
It was. I know it's an old story because it's from the 70s, but it's so relevant today because there. I mean, we say it all the time, Patricia, the veil is just thinner than it's ever been, and people are having all kinds of experiences and connections, and so just being able to revisit the story and see a reality that happened to a large group of people gives people some comfort that whatever they're experiencing is also not something crazy in their heads that they're making up, you know.
Well, that's right. And as you said at the beginning of the show, you put it perfectly. You said this is an evidentiary book, and he really did step by step piece this whole thing together in a very logical way, and it is a great book, so I hope people will enjoy it as much as we have, and certainly we've enjoyed having him on the show and explaining all of this to us about what went on. My gosh, I mean, those heavy items moving across the room, flying around in the air, that's amazing stuff. That's some power. That's some real power there.
Really is.
Gosh.
Huge power.
Yes. So, well, look, we're coming to, I hate to say goodnight because it's been so wonderful tonight, but we're going to have to say goodnight. And we will be back next week with another terrific show. And I think, if memory serves me correctly, we're going to be talking about creating from the heart with an expert in that. So can't wait to hear from this gentleman coming up. He's going to be calling in, I think, from Switzerland. So we'll have another exciting show next week for everybody. And again, please sign up and get our newsletter. Go to angelslighthouse.com, sign up for Helene's wonderful newsletter, and, of course, for Supernatural Girls, we want you on our list. And follow us on Twitter at SupernaturalGLZ. And we will have another book giveaway. We're just going to keep going ahead with this. People are really enjoying that. So
We'll
keep doing it. We'll keep giving away free stuff for you guys. And everybody have a great week. We'll see you next time.
Good night, Patricia.
Good night, Helene. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another radio adventure with Supernatural.